Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I podcasten Ukens vintips I dag har vi besøk av en mann som har reist langt. Han har vært på besøk siden onsdag I denne uken. Han nok sikkert litt reisetrøtt, men han har hatt mange fantastiske prestasjoner av sitt vineri rundt omkring I Norge, og nå han på besøk I podcaststudiet. Han en av de vinmakerne som jeg synes bemerker seg å levere bare bedre og bedre viner. Han kom inn med sine viner med enklere varianter, og I dag skal vi smake på hans to beste viner. Og vi snakker om Justin Tyler Willits, som kommer fra Santa Barbara, Der han født og oppvokst, og nå han på besøk I studio for å snakke litt om vin og den filosofien han har. Og da går vi over på engelsk, siden han ikke snakker norsk. Welcome, Justin. It's nice to be present in the same room as you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So how have Norway been so far?
Always good. My second trip here. I love it up this way.
So, Tyler, the first time it received good reviews, it was of some of your entry wines who have a good reuse on the Monopole shops and the Tyler brand was building up slowly. When did this start it?
Tyler Winery started back in 2005. I was 24. I was just apprenticing in another winery and I was encouraged to make a few barrels in the corner. Told that I would never learn faster than if I just put my dollars in the middle and really had to make the decisions for myself. And not thinking I was starting a winery, just made a little bit of wine, and those are the first Tyler wines.
How do you remember the first contact with Norway? How it started?
I believe it started around In Pursuit of Balance, if you remember those tastings. That was a movement in wine founded by Raj Parr and Jasmine Hirsch, which I was like an original member of. Basically, the idea was how do we kind of challenge these California ways of making wine, which tend to be pretty rich and ripe in style. Really the idea being like, we want to return to the sense of balance, return to the sense of, more moderate levels of alcohol, a little bit more freshness, a little bit more classically styled wine. So as those tastings were happening around the world, I think the Norway market also, kind of caught wind of those and started asking for more and more of the wines through the monopoly to come here.
Because what you did, it was not so common to the others. You come in with a very good price to the Norwegian market. So many find that Chardonnay was not so expensive. And then the taste was very good. I remember the first tasting, it was, And we have recommend the wines very often in Kapital and Finansavisen, now on newspaper and magazines. What I remember best is the kind of the fruitness acidity level who is not with high alcohol or with kind of too much oak. It was just clean. It's clean fruit. And we have seen after that first introduction to wine, especially from California, that Norwegian, they love wines from California. And that movement have gone up and also place that people are buying more expensive wines. And if you're telling a little bit the background of the wines we have today, because I have the estate you have started in 2017 in the studio, and tell me about this project here, because for me this is as a project who is a little bit very exciting, who's coming to taste. It's very good. It tastes fantastic today, but it had potential. So
basically the story of May starts in 2014. Up until that point, I was controlling more vineyard, but didn't own vineyards. So I would lease acreage and then control the farming and make the wine. And then my wife and I started talking about, well, I think it's probably time for us to be able to buy some land and maybe plant a vineyard. And so I saw this property come for sale. Mandy, my wife, and I went and took a look at it. But we didn't quite have it together financially yet to be able to pull the trigger on the purchase. And so quickly it got snatched up and I drove past it for about 9 months. And every time I would just kind of kick myself that I wasn't able to do it. And then lo and behold, it came back on the market and I was able to acquire it in 2015. And then I spent a few years just trying to understand the place, you know, making sure that the ground was fallow and so that we could return it to a completely organic state, which it had always been just in crops and in agriculture. So really quite natural to begin with, but I wanted to take it even a step further and really make sure things were sound before we planted. So from there and understanding the soils from digging pits and doing analysis, we then made our decisions to plant four different clones of Pinot Noir and four different selections of Chardonnay over the 27 acres of the vineyard there. So planted in 2017, my then 3-year-old son helped me plant the first vines. And
how did he help too? 3 years old, that's child work. Did he just help to be looking?
Oh yeah, he was just out there with his dad, just excited to participate and get a little dirty.
So, yeah, okay. Yeah. But the name is your wife's middle name,
correct?
Asked Tyler. And how big was that discussion?
There wasn't much of a discussion. She's always really let me lead with the wine making and the winery itself. I mean, she looks at this as really my project. I want her to really feel a part of this as well, though I started it before we were together.
But it's something true about is a nice woman behind every great man.
I don't know. I don't know about great, but, but yeah, she's been wonderfully supportive through the years. And so I figured if my middle name is the brand, then, you know, she should certainly have the vineyard.
Good here. If you see to California today and looks when you started as a young man, what have changed from you started with Tyler as a young man and to today? Do you see? Because for us who are here in Norway, as also in the wine channels, we taste a lot, we follow. It have become new heroes in the last 15 years. Jasmine Hirsch is one of them, and many others who have arrived Norway. They've done Norway as a visitor place who's come, and the Norwegian love it. But still, California wines are dominated by sales of one of the most crappy wines ever, the Falling Feathers. And this is bad, after my opinion. It's ruining the reputation of California as a brand, because it's so much more than it's just awful wine. I hope that you haven't tasted it, but if you haven't,
I haven't.
Please try it, Justin. It's like a concerto on steroids. It's something like that. but we're gonna leave that that leading Falling Feathers shit. But we're gonna go over to the quality, because if you see to the history of California wines, many people ask me why is not California wine more famous than Bordeaux and Champagne and so on. And this story that you have a time where you have non-alcohol sales, it have been, you know, the famous French tasting was coming up. It's a long way to the States. It have waking up with their own point system, the Uber Parker time, where the different kind of wines. And then in the beginning, maybe of the 2000s, something happened and the lower alcohol and more fruity wine was more popular. Is that the correct view of the history of why it have not become the long history as French and other countries in Europe?
Well, I think, you know, the history of wine obviously has been going on for hundreds, thousands of years. the history of California starts 100 or so years ago, 150 years maybe. But say in Santa Barbara, we only have 50 years of history growing grapes. So I think we're really just at the beginning of our journey as a wine producing region. But I think very quickly, as we're able to travel and share information more and more, whether we're in producing or in the consumer just enjoying wines, there's an ability to far faster today really experience wines produced around the world. And I think what we're seeing is that whether it's California or South Africa or wherever, there's beautiful wines made in a lot of places. It just France, Italy, Spain, you know, those are the standards.
But the information goes a little bit faster.
For sure.
So you were here in Norway just a few years after you launched your brand in Norway.
Yes. And it's a fantastic just begin to what wasn't even really supposed to be something.
But for our listeners, Santa Barbara, where is it? And what is the key points to why you haven't made wine earlier than 50 years ago? Why not? Where is it?
So Santa Barbara is right up the coast, about an hour and a half's drive from Los Angeles. So we're right at this point of intersection of the south-facing coastline, where the coastline corrects and then turns back west-facing. So in these now transverse valleys, because of that coastline being south-facing, these valleys rotate 90 degrees. And so we have these really unique strips of land that are running east-west, open to the Pacific Ocean, where there's this really strong onshore breeze coming off the Pacific that turns out is really great for growing wine grapes. So that combined with all these marine sedimentary soils of about 20, 25 million years, really allow grapes the opportunity to become fully ripe, but also really retain acidity well. So you can make fresh, beautiful wines that have energy, that have precision, and they can be fully impactful, but without really high levels of alcohol. So that's why Santa Barbara is so good. But you know, someone has to come and do it first, right? And so most of wine country was once ranch land. This was grass-fed, free-range cattle. This was flowers. This was vegetables and fruit. And so we have a really diverse agricultural tradition.
Because anything can grow there.
Everything grows.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not so... You have to decide, and then also the industry is coming in with new areas.
For sure, and if you look at how much has now been planted in 50 years, it's really quite a lot.
Yeah, but that's also because of pricing, because the land have not been so expensive to Napa and Sonoma.
True, yeah. But if you look at where pricing was, say 15, 20 years ago in Napa and Sonoma, it's changed considerably.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's starting as well, unfortunately, where we are too.
Okay.
I mean, I'm very thankful to own a few vineyards now and have kind of made my moves, let's say. But
what were you talking about in price when you are, if I'm going to buy a hectare, is it in a medium plus place where we can buy 1 hectare of vineyard? How much do I have to pay, or acres as you?
Yeah, I mean, probably for a really high quality acre of Santa Rita Hills Pinot Noir Chardonnay that's already planted, you're probably looking at 80 to 100,000 US per acre, something like that.
It's money. Yeah.
Yeah.
But how do you, are you planning to do more? Do you buy if you see something you like, or it have to be?
The problem is I don't come from a real wealthy family. I was a very blue collar, middle class kid. My parents weren't in wine. So being able to establish May, which is a 27 acre vineyard, we also, with a few friends, acquired another vineyard called Fiddlesticks, which is right across the street from the most iconic vineyard in the area called Sanford and Benedict. So today I actually have control a pretty large surface area.
Yeah.
Because the Fiddlesticks vineyard itself is about 40 hectare.
But could it be something positive that the price is going up, but then also the investment have to be more secure? That so when you are making first starts of a movement with, you better make a good wine who is premium range, so you don't produce lower quality.
100%.
I'm not so fan of lower quality. So.
Nor am I.
Good.
You know, and so I think Santa Barbara, generally speaking, that the level of quality is really quite high across the board. Hmm. There are more specific areas like the Santa Rita Hills, which is where I focus, that really are, I would say, world class.
Hmm.
And those are getting planted out quite quickly.
Yeah.
It seems like every few years when they release a new vineyard map, you see this whole ribbon of land that was once raw is now just getting more layered and filled in more and more and more. To really, I think outside of Burgundy or Champagne, this is probably the most contiguous planting of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay anywhere in the world.
Yeah. Okay. Because there are more areas in the California district where you can plant wines. I mean, it has to be.
Yeah. The beauty of California is we don't have nearly the regulation that the European
you do anything,
countries
well,
have.
Yeah, but of course, quality. And I've also seen in the Californian or San Francisco wine bars, and the interest for wine is high. So you can't come with anything rubbish into the market if you want to say it's decent.
At a minimum, and I think this is a really wonderful moment in time for California wine. I think whether you're interested in Italian varieties or Pinot Noir and Chardonnay or Cabernet or whatever, I think there's never been more really fantastic wines made in all regions of California, but specifically for us, I mean, my focus has always been on trying to make these really aspirational wines, like the May wines we're checking out today, but to the Santa Barbara County wines that you were speaking about that are at the Vinopoly here. I mean, I really want to deliver value. I want to tell the story of Santa Barbara, and the best way for me to do that is certainly with a more moderately priced wine that still is going to really over deliver for the category, or at least that's our intention. Is how do we make a wine that's fresh and vibrant, that's going to age really well, but also be ready to go tonight if you choose to pull that cork. That to me is really the line we're trying to kind of thread,
And with that words, we have to go a little bit to the commercial, and Justin and me are coming back and having a taste of his two wines. I assure you, it will be very fantastic, because he just recently started to talk about his lovely area, Santa Barbara, and he smiles in the a lot. So it's going to be, we are back in a moment. Then we are doing some commercial, and then we are coming back, and then we go to the wines, and then we're going to have are there something you want to talk about when we are now talking about California? And I'm thinking that the potential to talk about the export market and how important that is for you, because you could sell only in the States if you want to. So it's a decision to do,
for sure,
to be in the market. So I think I'm going to go for that. And
that's
and
great.
The world is smaller. If everyone has to have some of your wines, you have to decide which market you want to be in.
For sure.
Et av merkene Temtec nå fører franske La Sommelier. I denne serien finner du blant annet vinskapet E-Seller, som det første smarttilkoblede vinskapet tilgjengelig på markedet. E-Seller et praktfullt resultat av flere års utvikling mot perfeksjonisme. Estetisk tiltalende design med vakre finisher, det nyeste innen kjøleteknologi og nøyaktighet i hver minste detalj. Organiser vinsamlingen din i det smarte hyllesystemet, utviklet for å romme et stort antall flaskeformater, opp til 9,5 cm i diameter. Bordeaux-flaskeformatet ikke lenger normen, og med e-celler kan du lagre alle favorittflaskene dine uten unntak. Ved å koble vinskapet til mobilen din, registrerer skapet automatisk at du legger inn og fjerner vinflaskene dine, og oppdaterer det i en tilhørende app. Dette fantastiske vinskapet kjøper du på temtech.no.
And then we are back from the commercial, and in the studio we have a visit of one of the greatest winemakers who have ever been in the studio, and we have some few, but he's a shy, a little bit, what should I say, he's not so comfortable in the podcast studio, but he loves when he talks about Santa Barbara and his wines, and that's why he's here. And Justin, if in front of us we have from Santa Rita Hills, the Chardonnay and the Pinot Noir. And first of all, you have to have the explanation of why it's called STA.Rita Hills. in the label.
Long story, but the short version yeah. is that when Richard Sanford and Brian Babcock and a few others all went to establish the appellation, now about 20, 25 years ago, there was also a winery down in Chile, I believe, that had a trademark for this, or it was the Santa Rita Winery or something yes. that was owned by a large wine conglomerate, and they weren't willing to budge. So Richard Sanford jumped on a plane and flew down to Chile and took a few bottles of Santa Rita Hills wine down there and tried to explain to them why it was like apples and oranges and, you know, shouldn't be an issue. And that was the solution that yeah. Santa Rita needed to be labeled as STA dot, to properly satisfy everyone.
Yes. It's a funny information that commercial brands are
drives me nuts.
Okay. But let us taste on the white first. Is okay?
Sure.
Yeah. The white is a kind of a wine for me when I tasted this earlier. For this is the first wine, and you have used the clones Eden and Pumar on this. And please tell me a little bit what they are doing with the grape of Chardonnay.
So this is actually planted to a few different clones. So the majority of the Pinot Noir is planted to Mount Eden and Pomard. The Chardonnay is planted to selections that I've used throughout the Santa Rita Hills really well. So this is clone 4, this is Wente 15 and 76 are the four selections in the Chardonnay. So I chose those just because they are all vine material that I've used across many vineyards in the Santa Rita Hills with a high level of success for a number of years. Specifically, I feel almost all of those clones really allow for this really sharp, crystalline, pure expression of Chardonnay, which is what the Santa Rita wants to produce. But I think these selections really allow me to do that even better.
Because the Chardonnay is a kind of, you have the sensation of alcohol in it, you have the sensation of oak, you have the sensation of, but it's fruit driven all over the place. You know, it's clear. And you have also a kind of saltiness who's coming. And that's kind of is what I'm looking at when I taste the wine. You haven't made your best wine yet, but it's very good what you have. So I see, this is potential for the future. But this is my words. What do you think of the explanation of your wines?
Well, I think the Santa Rita always is going to be led with this sea-driven brine and minerality. There's always going to be this level of salinity. There's always going to be this level of citrus in the wines. So the Chardonnay here in the Santa Rita tends to be a little bit more on, let's call it like the margarita mix, kind of lemon-lime spectrum of flavors.
The margarita mix, I like that.
Yeah, a little bit more than stone fruit or tropical. Yeah. If you pick things ripe enough, sure, they're going to kind of end up there, but in the range that I'm choosing to produce my wines, kind of in these more moderate levels of say 12.5 to 13% alcohol, you're going to be on the citrus for sure. So what I'm really excited about at May, which I'm still getting my hands around, this is only the second release of this wine, is the level of crystallinity in the wine.
Yeah.
So there's a really pure signal through the wine. And pick a vigneron friend of mine or a sommelier who's been through the cellar. Everyone is always, the comment is always just, I can't believe these vines are 5 years old.
Yeah.
You know, there's already so much power. There's already so much complexity coming from such a young vineyard site. And I think that really speaks to our growing season and where we are in the world. So because we have this really long cold growing season, so it's snowing out here today. We're starting to break bud right now, though the mountains behind Santa Barbara are covered in snow. We've had a very cold, very, very wet winter. But what comes of this place is a season that starts in, say, early to mid-March, and we're not going to harvest until sometime in September. So it's a really extended growing season. And because it's so cool and because it's so long, we really have fully ripe, fully developed fruit. At again, these lower levels of sugar, which in turn equal a more reasonable level of alcohol. And having that more reasonable level of alcohol is going to allow us to have wines that are a little bit are going to sit a little bit more upright. They're going to be a little bit more precise because they have the acidic backbone and that level of minerality to really make you salivate, make you want that next glass, want that next sip. And
because it's easy drinking, but in the same time, a concentration who makes you want to drink another glass.
Yep.
But if you go into to food, because this is food-driven wine, I mean, it's good alone, but there are, I'm thinking food at once. What is your favorite meal to your Chardonnay?
So Santa Barbara's right near the coast, similar to here. So I grew up with seafood. So for me, it's local halibut. It's the Sprott prawns, which are world-class when those run in the channel. It's the local sea urchin or uni. It's all those sorts of things. But, you know, you also
can't...
But it's
naturally only cooked or grilled or what do you think of the...
The halibut, whether it's a crudo, you know, it's just a lightly cured something or on the grill, any or all are going to go great. The urchin, we just eat raw. Grow up with a lot of what we call spiny lobster. So it's a lobster without claws. It's just the tail. Those are harvested in the fall. All of these things are wonderful, wonderful pairs for the Chardonnay.
Yeah, because it's for me, I taste it as a food wine is driven. It's not so in sense of greatness or power. It have a kind of elegance in it. And you said it yourself. You just recently started, you know, so that's why I said this wine here. We haven't seen the potential yet. We haven't seen it. And I think when the wines are getting older, you will come a step or two up. Even if it's good now, we will go up and see. But also that then the points and the look for that wine will come. And this is, I think, it's one of the wines I have set in the cellar and see what's happened in 10 years with both the prices and the location to Norway, because this is this. I think this is going to be popular, very popular. And yesterday, I think you're doing a good job with the Chardonnay. But my favorite is the Pinot Noir. And why is the Pinot Noir? And it is the same thing as a white wine. I don't know. I never made a wine, but I assume it's more difficult to make a red wine than a white wine.
I think the opposite.
You think the opposite. And why?
I always joke that white wine making is more like chess, and red wine making is more like checkers.
Oh, it is.
So in white wine, there's nowhere to hide. So every move you make, it's going to be clearly visible in the wine. So you're always having to think 2, 3, 4 steps ahead, both in the out in the field and also in our picking decisions, and then certainly in the cellar with our winemaking. Whereas red winemaking is a little bit more forgiving, though certainly just as much thought goes into it. There's a little bit more room for error, let's say. But I mean,
yeah, but when you say okay, it's if you do any mistake with the wine. With the white wine, you are public, you know, at once. But the red wine are more, okay, but it is slightly more difficult, but you can hide the faults if you want.
I will say, though, it's much harder to grow Pinot Noir than it is Chardonnay.
Yeah. And that's what I meant, is that it's not easy to make Pinot Noir in a climate like that. And also when you are doing in that kind of category here. And when you talked, I have to taste. And I liked it a lot. And even if this 2019 is a young version of it, and probably, I don't know what your meaning are, in the great drinking position for that wine will be maybe 5, 6 years ahead, then it have, even if now from a Pinot Noir glass is good. So this is what I think is best for duck breast or something. I mean, food-driven. The acidity levels here are very good. But also that kind of low alcohol, what you see. You don't feel it, but it's there. And then you have also the concentration and also long acidity levels. But the fruit who's on the top is amazing. It's good.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, again, there's nothing more encouraging than having people really like what you do, and it only gives you more confidence to go out there and further push. I mean, I feel like I make my best wines every year, and so I think there's always room for us to be continually improving. I'm sure it drives my team and my wife crazy, but I really like that constant evolution that, hey, how can we get a little bit better, even if it's just incremental, even if it's not going to necessarily show up in the wine. The little tweaks we're making in the cellar and just how we work as a team together. I mean, I think it's in that constant desire to improve that really something special can come.
We have a word in Norway we use often when we are talking, and it's called laskene, who is kind of easy drinking, drinking a word for to drink. It's just easy. And it's, and this is, it's really good. I hope you will increase your allocation to Norway. And that leads me to the next question. When I have been in California sometimes, one of my questions to all winemakers are, why are you not exporting more and using more time on export when you have so good wines? And they tell me, no, this is so much paperwork to export. It's true that there's a lot of paperwork to export when you can sell to all the states in the states, or
I think it's just a different way of looking at the wines you make and how you want to exist in the world of wine. I mean, everyone's business is set up a little differently, but for me, I've always wanted to put my wines forward in front of the best palates and in the best markets, whether that be London or Paris or Tokyo or Oslo or Stockholm or wherever. It's, hey, I want to put these wines in front of people who are of a really high level of wine knowledge and have a tradition of drinking wine. And it's there that I think we can best kind of get the story of Santa Barbara out. I mean, me selling all the wine back in California or just across the US is great, but it's amazing being able to travel around the world and have your wine across all these fantastic places.
How many countries do you export to today?
Oh, probably close to 20.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not too many, because it needs time to also to travel there. So it's
you can't go to all of them all the time. Yeah, I've got a lot of wine to make. I've got two little boys at home and that and the vineyards
but you also need time alone. So you travel then, okay?
The time on the plane where I can just kind of do the mental Tetris and kind of get my brain back straight.
The mental Tetris on plane. That's good to hear you.
So,
but what are your thoughts about the future of this estate and what you're making of wine? Are you growing? Are you going to be there? Are you going to have more people employed? What's happening with the brand? Because you are in Norway, the Tyler brand have become a name in the monopole. So many monopole employees and many wine lovers, they use it as a go-to wine because they know its quality. Just like Hirsch, but not like Falling Feathers.
I have no partners. I have no investors. I've grown this as from a kid that was 24. I'm 42 now. We don't work off of a pro forma. I've grown as I've had opportunities for something I feel is special. And part of that growth also is, hey, I want to make enough wine where I can get it out around the world. I mean, as a kid from Santa Barbara, born and raised, right over the hill is this fantastic place to grow wine grapes. I really want to be a part of what gets that story out there around the world to really, really share these wines with the rest of the world. And so doing that is making more and more wine to be able to satisfy these markets. Unfortunately, May is only so big. But as these vines mature and as they establish, we should hopefully have a little bit more crop off of there. And so hopefully in the future, we can get a little bit more wine in
Norway. From outside, you can see it very easily that you're just the beginning of a great future. And I know it because I taste many, many thousand wines a year. And when you heard you're coming to Norway, I called the importer and said, I want to meet Justin. And it's great to have you here in the studio. And I assure you, you will come back in some years maybe, and then you will see that the ratings and the allocation is less than the rating is up and the price is going up. Because this wine here today will be more expensive in the future, for sure. And if you buy it, there are some wines in the Norwegian market, and I will say to all the listeners, this is the wine you should buy, for sure. Justin, you have made a good work with these wines, and I'm so happy for you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ukens vindtips med Svein en Finansavisen podcast. Programleder Svein Lindin, produsent Lars Brenden Skram, og podcast- og videoansvarlig Marius Mørk Larsen. Ansvarlig redaktør Trygve Hegnar.